I'm Christopher Lydon, following André Debus III through his memoir, Townie, into the murky depths of American manhood. This is a story about a bullied little New England boy who discovers himself, first as a fighter, then as a writer, with the same name, oddly enough, as his famous writer dad. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. André Debus's story unfolds downstream from the scene of Mark Wahlberg's almost Oscar movie, The Fighter, down the Merrimack River from Lowell to Lawrence to Haverhill to Newburyport. Same bad Boston accents, same rough bars, same mystery about where did it all go? Where's the old community? André Debus, I wish we were talking at 7th and Main in Haverhill or on Lime Street in Newburyport, and I would be looking for some of these rough kids, Cody Perkins and Clay Whalen, to come around the corner and see your reaction.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're both dead.
Really?
One became a prize fighter and died of a drug overdose. The other died in prison. And that's not uncommon for a lot of the guys I grew up with and wrote about in these books, or in this book. It's funny I said these books. You know why I said that? Because I've tried to write this as a novel for about 25 years.
Interesting.
And it failed 3 times in a row. So this is finally how it came out.
Is it okay to associate it with Mickey Wadd, as we say?
Yeah, I mean, although I'm not by any stretch of the imagination a boxer of his degree. Look, if you're on those streets, they feel the same. They just feel the same. Mm. And, you know, when I saw The Fighter, I thought, my God, somebody finally captured it on film. It's the first time anyone's captured Merrimack Valley working class scene on film, ever. It's a work of art. I think it's a great film.
Jack Kerouac's town was a different place 50 years ago.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would hope. But he also called it a fucking depressed mill town. So he said, well, what was Lowell? And, you know, I say it with love in my heart. I teach at Lowell, and I love the young people I teach from that town. But these tend to be tough mill towns still. There have been some great resurgence. You know, Haverhill's got some bars now that, you know, have canopies and microbrews going on, and there's a lot of development going on. But I get a similar vibe when I'm down there, especially down the avenues.
Your book, Townie, closes with a gorgeous scene. It's a recitation of the Our Father in your kind of summing up of where you've been at your father's funeral. I'd love you just to read that, André.
Thank you. I'd love to. East Broadway lay 30 yards behind us on the other side of a chain-link fence. The priest was just finishing up, and I could hear it back through the trees behind me. A car coming fast down the asphalt, its engine upshifting and getting the gas. The priest was asking us to say the Lord's Prayer, and I didn't want to give this car any of my attention, but now it came into view as it sped west, a blue lowrider, the center of its spinning wheels a flash of chrome. A kid leaned out the passenger window and yelled at us, "Fucking faggots!" Then they were gone, the driver downshifting for the drop of the hill through the trees. The priest smiled and shook his head. "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." I began reciting the words with everyone else, but my tongue had become my beating heart and my hands had turned oily and light, and that old rage sat up inside me as if it had just lain down for a short nap. "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." I didn't move, but saw myself running in my overcoat and suit to my car, starting it up and tearing down East Broadway through the pines, on earth as it is in heaven. They'd be a half mile ahead of me by now, maybe more. Give us this day our daily bread. These little punks with no respect for anyone, my eyes scanning for any flash of blue, and forgive us our trespasses. At the stop sign at the end of East Broadway, Charlie's Variety Store across the street, I'd cut right and accelerate for downtown. Soon I'd be on River Street. On my left, the rusted guardrail and bare trees, their Merrimack River flowing east, the boxboard factory on the other side, gray smoke unfurling from its stacks. I'd pass the Hill Street where the hospital used to be, the emergency room where they'd stitched up Sam's chin and Vinny smoked under the awning, his eyes on me. Farther up the street, the base of Nettle Hill, Russ Bowman on his back in the classroom, his face getting punched over and over. Then I'd be on Water Street, Captain Chris's restaurant, a gay bar now, that back kitchen where Charlie Pierce had sprayed me with scalding water, and I'd gone after him, this killer of kids like me, as we forgive those who trespass against us. No blue car yet. To my right, the concrete retaining wall for the parking lot of the shopping plaza where Crazy Jack had yelled on a warm, crowded Sunday afternoon, "How's it feel to be a chicken shit?" Then the traffic lights at the intersection, where 10 years after that night at the 104 Club, a loaded 38 in my father's Red Sox jacket pocket, Ben Wallace, drunk behind the wheel of a dented sedan, had seen me walking along the sidewalk, and he revved his engine till the chassis vibrated and yelled, "You still want to go at it, Dubas?" And I drive straight through the intersection, the Basileer Bridge to my right, Bradford shimmering on the other side. And if there was still no blue ahead of me, I'd head deep into downtown. On the riverside, the old Woolworths building, Valhalla's Diner, Mitchell's clothing store, where our mother had put clothes for us on layaway she still could not afford. Past Casey's office supplies and the post office in Washington Square. Then the bars of Washington Street, the Lido, the Chit Chat Lounge, the Tap, and Steve Lynch swallowing his front teeth, as we forgive those who trespass against us. At the black trestle of Railroad Square, I turn right and upshift past the old leather tanneries, the berm of the Boston and Maine rail line to my left, the abandoned brewery coming up, the turn under the iron trestle for Lafayette Square, Devin Wallace straddling my chest, knocking my head against concrete again and again, the martial arts studio in Haffenreffer Gas, the brown rush of the little river flowing through drainage pipes beneath cracked asphalt, no blue yet. No blue. The shadow of another trestle above me as I downshifted up Winter Street. The booth where I pumped gas and waited for the Lynches and the Murphys to come get me. Gone now. An empty concrete lot. To chain link fence around it. And before the Greek church, there'd be the sharp left for the avenues. Of course, the avenues. Still poor, abandoned cars on the sidewalks. But now I'd see satellite dishes screwed to the vinyl sides of some of the houses. Now I'd see security lights and bred pit bulls. The lumberyard's still there, the concertina wire coiled at the top of the fence and gleaming in this April sun. My brother and our dead, stabbed friend passing me 2x4s. And look, a flash of blue gunning up 4th Avenue. And lead us not into temptation. And me following in my family car, an old used Toyota wagon, the booster seats of my two youngest still strapped in the back, their raging father in his suit and tie accelerating after the boys he'd been, hoping he'll find them, hoping he won't, but deliver us from evil. Amen. There was the young captain's orders in the air, the report of 7 rifles firing 3 times each, the acrid smells of hot brass and cordite, a sob from one of my sisters or my mother, then the low, mournful wheeze of the bagpipe, its nearly frantic search for the notes becoming Amazing Grace, the man in his kilt walking slowly off into the trees where we heard the last note without him, like some lovely echo we all one day leave behind.
Thank you, Andre Dubuis.
Thank you.
From the tail end of Towny. I was struck, Andre, that so much of Dickens in this book, not just the autobiography of a writer through grim beginnings, but Towny seemed to me to be David Copperfield in a certain way, plus a lot of crystal meth and pills and junk TV.
I like that, David Copperfield and crystal meth.
Plus Vietnam in the background, but the social anger in Dickens and your kind of rage at whatever it was produced that town, not to mention your family circumstance,
It
seemed to me to mark you as a child of the master.
Well, those are sweet words to me. I love Dickens for all those reasons. I was a bullied kid, like a lot of kids. I was a new kid in school. We moved 2 or 3 times a year for cheaper rent. I got beat up a lot. At 15, I snapped and I started to fight back. And I began to physically fight, you know, almost weekly for about 10 years. It's just what I did.
Not a mark on your handsome face, if I may say.
Well, how do I say this without sounding like an asshole? I tended to win more than I lost because I was so angry. And I learned a really valuable trick, which is just you get the first one in. You know, when I got to the University of Texas at Austin, and I began to study imperialism and colonialism and the history of our sordid world, You know, my hatred of bullies and cruelty and meanness just got institutionalized, and it just got deeper inside me.
Hmm. Well, that's a Dickens connection, too. I mean, he wrote endlessly about the hometown squalor of the great imperial nation.
Yeah.
Unsparingly. And there was great fun in it, in Mr. Micawber, but there was great evil in it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see the fun as much. I mean, I should. The truth is, I'm actually kind of a fun guy. I enjoy life, and I love a good joke. But whenever I look back at that time, I see a lot of lost kids with single, overwhelmed mothers and absent fathers and alcoholism and drug use and bad things happening. And I feel really lucky to have gotten out of there. And I actually feel, you know, a friend of mine said once, he said, you know, this would be years before I wrote this book, he said, you know, you're always talking about how rough it was growing up, but, you know, you're so full of shit. I said, well, why is that? He said, there's always such love in your voice when you talk about it. Which I thought was really interesting. I think it says something about, I don't know. I don't know what it says.
No, it does say something about you, and not to blow a lot of smoke at you, but, I mean, you're known as the nicest guy in the writing business. You're generous. You're generous to your towns. You're generous to other writers. Your father was notoriously generous in his writing groups, his inclusiveness.
Yep. He was.
And you have the best of that, I think.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I wanted to ask about the Marxism, because there was a period in your early 20s when you were determined to start a revolution.
That's all I wanted to do. Well, what happened was I discovered art. I also fell in love with a couple of rich girls, and they're all very nice, and so were their parents, and it didn't seem right to shoot all of them. I began to read fiction, and then I began to write, much to my surprise, and I remember vividly the day I finished writing my first short story, which was not a good story. Flaubert says a bad book comes as sincerely from a man's soul as a good one. Oh, shit, sincerity's not enough? No. But I remember feeling some powerful things that day. I was driving around the back roads of Lynn, where I lived, and for the first time, I could see every tree. I was in that heightened state of awareness that writing gives us, and I think reading, and drug-free, and I could see every vein of creosote in the telephone poles and the sweep of the wires and every pebble and every tree, and they didn't look like woods anymore. I could see every tree, and every tree had its own sacred journey, and I couldn't look at people as groups anymore after that. I just couldn't look at people in a group. I couldn't talk about rich people anymore. I couldn't talk about poor people. It seemed dishonest.
Sounds like Henry James's Princess Casamassima, about a young revolutionary who is in a plot to blow up the world and assassinate people, but he goes to Rome and he sees beauty. And he says, no, we got to save the beautiful.
I've got to read that. I haven't read that.
It's a glorious book. It's his most Dickensian book.
Oh, well, that's high on my list now. Thank you.
Yeah. But I just wonder, how does a man of your experience and your conscience see the Merrimack Valley, this flight of jobs, this drain of social protections, rampant abuse of people, of drugs, of substance, you name it?
Right.
What do we do with that?
You know, I can't speak so authoritatively anymore about the Merrimack Valley because I really don't live there. I still have dear friends in Haverhill, and I visit them, you know, monthly. And I, you know, spend time in those bars, which have changed. I see a lot of heroic efforts in Haverhill, number one, and Lowell, where I teach. I see a lot of efforts to really try to bring these places up, both on the social service level, on the, you know, real estate level, on the all that education level. To me, I think the big taboo in this entire country is class, social class. I can talk all about my grandmother having had sex with me from age 6 to 15, which she didn't, but, you know, we're more comfortable talking about that kind of thing than social class. And, yeah, I think it's time we start talking more about it.
Or empire, if I may.
Yeah, empire. Thank you.
Domination.
Yeah, domination.
Fear.
All the blood on our hands. Absolutely.
Hmm. In this book, little bullied Andre becomes a fighter because he hates himself for stepping back. And then he comes to hate himself for smashing faces in a kind of uncontrolled frenzy. But along the way, he discovers this membrane, an invisible film around the self and around the other. And it's fascinating not only because it serves him in fist fights, but it also becomes part of his modus operandi as a writer. I wish you'd talk about that membrane.
Yeah, very strange, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's something that was semi-conscious, this thought of the membrane in my life, and then became more clarified as I began to describe it in this book. But let's just say, you know, I'm not a badass. You know, there are 20 men within three blocks of us right now who could probably kick my ass. But what I am is an experienced fighter. And one thing that I realized that would constantly hit me was I would see people who weren't experienced fighters and they would do this shoving match thing. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Experienced fighters don't do any foreplay. Once they know it's a fight situation, they pound you in the face as hard as they can. Well, how do you do that? Well, anyone can learn to throw a punch. What I learned was that was just part of what you have to do to fight. What you have to do is something really inappropriate. You have to break. Like right now, we're sitting 3 feet apart. If I reach over and touch your knee, it's inappropriate. I'm violating your personal space. But to reach over and punch you in the face is such a violation of someone's invisible boundaries that should exist in civil society. But once you learn how to do it, I realized, that hymen, psychological hymen in you is always broken. You can always do it. Once you break through it, you know how to do it, and you'll keep doing it. And that's what that's the barrier, that once you learn to cross that, you can fight. But to the writing, I had a very interesting, strange experience when I first began to write. It felt so familiar, and I couldn't quite place what it was. But it was another kind of membrane where I was allowing myself to seep into the being, into the private skin of another, an imaginary other, but I had to somehow disappear to become them. In the same way that as a fighter, I had to let my fear of my safety disappear and my sense of myself disappear. And the same was true in writing, which was really an interesting insight for me.
You describe along the way a counseling session with a young kid who's suicidal, Donnie, in Phoenix House in Haverhill. He's got a carving knife at his own throat, and you've got to calm him down. But it was kind of mental trick of getting inside Donnie. I want you to give him...
Yeah, the reason I put that in the book is it seemed emblematic of that bridge I was crossing between having been a fighter to a writer. And I worked as an overnight counselor at this halfway house, and you know, I heard something in the kitchen. I went out, and there was Donnie G, who'd been through just horrible childhood and raised himself on the streets of Boston, dead father in prison, on and on. And he's weeping. He's standing in his boxer shorts, and he's pressing the point of the butcher knife to his carotid artery, and he looks like he has every intention of driving it in. And I was able to talk him into the other room and told him to bring the knife and sit down and let's talk. And basically what was haunting him was he didn't know how to live anymore. All the well-meaning counselors in the house were telling him he couldn't swear anymore. He had to stop fighting. He had to control his temper. And he literally didn't know how he was going to be Donnie if he couldn't say fuck when he was angry and if he couldn't throw a punch when he was angry to defend himself. And what I found myself saying to him was something I only could have said from having lived my own life, which was, brother, you don't ever want to lose that. What if you're walking down the street with a good-looking woman, somebody causes some shit? You want to be able to take them out. You're not going to get rid of that. They just want you to add more tools to your toolbox. Put that over there, keep it, and you got to learn how to talk to people who aren't trying to fight you. And you don't want to swear all the time in good company. And it was a really wonderful conversation. And he put the knife down and went back to bed. And I told the counselors the next day about his suicidal attempt. I felt as if some truth had passed between us, and I felt I had no right counseling him, by the way. I didn't have any experience in that. But here's the weird thing, I guess this is my point. I've always felt between two worlds, the world of the middle-class, educated, book-reading people I became, and the world of the blue-collar, more primal class that I also was part of. So I've never felt part of either. But in that moment, I could call on both experiences to help Donnie, and I was grateful to have been able to do that. I saw him, by the way, at Mass General about 2 years later.
Really?
And I was visiting my old man after he'd been run over. And I hear, "Hey, fucking stink bum!" And I look, and there's Donnie G with a cigarette. He works at Mass General, his blue shirt sticking out. "How's it fucking hanging?" "Hey, Donnie, good to see you." He said, "You fucking stink bum." And he gave me a hug. It was all good.
Andre Dubuque, there's a wonderful second beginning almost in your book, Townie, in which you're describing a transition from punching people, punishing your body in workouts, and becoming a writer. I'd love you to read it.
Sure. Thank you. I drove straight to Austin and spent 3 weeks living with Kurosh in a small house he was renting not far from campus. I write every morning, then walk to the gym and lift weights, but it was different now. I didn't think much anymore about having to fight anyone. Fear and rage used to help me push that iron bar off my chest, but now it was just a good way to sweep all those words and sentences out of my head. The harder I worked in the gym, the emptier my head got, and the next morning seemed to go better. Writing was becoming as ingrained a habit as workouts, a private and necessary thing I had to do, but I did not see this as my work or my purpose. I didn't even appear to be any good at it. And whenever Kurosh asked me what I was doing with my life, I'd shrug my shoulders and say, "Man nemi dunam, I do not know." Ever since I was a boy, running from other boys, I've been making myself into a man who did not flee, a man who planted his feet and waited for that moment when throwing a punch was the only thing to do, waited for that invisible membrane around me to fall away, and I'd gather once again the nerve and will to shatter another's. But I had discovered a new membrane now, the one between what we think and what we see, between what we believe and what is. Years later, I would read this definition of sincerity in Nadine Gordimer's novel, A Sun Story. Sincerity is never having an idea of oneself. I was still the boy who could not bear being perceived a certain way, a boy who'd learned to fight and get hurt or worse just so he would not be seen as weak. But what did being seen have to do with writing well? It was time to start seeing. I sat at that desk feeling small and self-absorbed and with little ability to do this one thing I felt pulled to do. But this negative self-scrutiny was just another form of insincerity. I had to disappear altogether.
Hmm. It seemed to me, Andre, reading this gorgeous book, that the arc of it is about a neglected, almost abandoned son coming around very gradually by painful stages to his father's vocation, which was writing, and then almost afterward to his father.
Mm. I think that's an accurate description.
There's one little line in the early days, you're taught in Iowa, he's teaching and learning writing, and there are parties with the likes of Kurt Vonnegut and others, and you're upstairs just listening to the gab and raucous laughter, cookouts and stuff, and like any other cookout party, except words like novel keep getting dropped in, or names like Hemingway
or Chekhov.
Right.
It was very literary. These are young artists, man. A lot of them have gone on to do great things, like Vonnegut, of course.
But it's almost a DNA thing kicking in, or some... through all your miseries at age 12, as they would say in church, God had a plan for your life. You somehow intuited a vocation for your life.
You know, as you know, this is an accidental memoir that grew from an essay I was writing, and I had no intention of writing a memoir, but I'm really grateful that I was able to get into all this and get it out, because there's a lot I've been trying to express over the years. I tried to write this without writing about my father or my mother or my siblings. I didn't want to violate their privacy. I thought, well, look, you can write about your own fighting. I don't know who said this. It's a great line from some writer who said, look, if you're going to write memoir, you should be able to sue yourself for libel. And I love that. I said, okay, that's the kind of memoir I'm going to write. I'm not going to let myself off the hook. I'm going to talk about all the bad things I did and all the cowardly acts I had before I did worse things. But I'm going to leave my family alone. And I wrote that first draft, Chris, and it was such a lie. It was such a dishonest draft because I didn't grow up alone. So I began to let in what was also going on at my house, which is, you know, a suicidal brother and a, you know, on and on. It's in the book. And my father's absence became a real presence as I wrote. And I could not keep writing about it. And one of the things this book has taught me, and again, I love that E.M. Forster line, you know, how do I know what I think until I say it? But one of the things it taught me was, you know, my father was, he didn't abandon us. You know, he picked us up once a week on a Sunday. We went out to eat. That's how a lot of divorces happened in the 70s. But I realized that my life growing up was much more fatherless than I had acknowledged to myself. So writing that was part of the insight. And also I'm a father of three teenagers myself, and I know the difference between the kind of father I get to be and the kind of father my my father was in the divorce of the 70s.
What was the process of discovering a kind of personal family anger under all that down and out on the Merrimack River anger?
It felt a lot like writing a novel does when it starts to go better. When you feel the horse start to run on its own, when you feel as if, and I've described this in writing classes, but I think it's a huge difference in writing between making something up and imagining it. I think the job of the novelist is not to make stuff up, but to imagine, to really let your imagination take you someplace deep and scary or exalted or wherever it's going to go without a plan. And then sometimes, if the stars align, you feel as if you've sunken down into your psyche and there's an underwater current and it's taking you somewhere and you're just floating down that road. Sometimes it's a raging river, sometimes it's a brook, but it has its own direction, its own life force. So to answer your question, once I allowed myself to paint the picture of my overwhelmed, depressed mother raising four kids alone, which, by the way, by alone, I mean alone. All the family was from Louisiana. That's another insight I had. There wasn't a sister, an aunt, an uncle, a cousin, a grandparent. No one was there to help out this poor woman. And once I brought some of the family shadow in, I felt again I was in that deeper current. I felt I was writing on a much more honest level. I felt the book sort of come alive the way a novel can when you're working on it in that way. And I learned quite a bit. I love that about writing, you know, that Grace Paley line, we write what we don't know we know. I had always assumed, oh yeah, all that rage and all those fights, that's because I was a bullied boy who learned how to throw a right cross. And much to my surprise, I had a knockout punch and I just loved using it whenever I had the right opportunity, and usually had to be someone being cruel to someone else. And that was just part of it. That was just part of the rage. That was probably a third of it. There was also the hopelessness and the feeling the house was never safe and the, you know, we were all alone. And that was a deep, deep piece of learning. And I'm still not free of it. You know, I truly believe that it's just you against the world and good luck. And I try to be open to the thought of a loving presence out there, but it's a challenge.
May I say, I interviewed your father a number of times, read a great deal of his work, admired him hugely, enjoyed him. But in some strange way, your father is more interesting in your book than in his own. And he comes alive in a different sort of way.
Well, good. I feel better. Because I really am worried that he might not come across well. And that was one of the big demons, of course, was how do you write about a dead parent who's not here to defend herself or himself? And the last thing I want to do is betray this man I loved and miss, the way we all love and miss our family, who's gone. But I'm glad to hear you say that.
You don't make him simple. He's at war with himself in certain respects. He knows he's neglecting a big part of his responsibility, but he's decided to put another one first. To me, maybe the most interesting part of the puzzle is that he's a Catholic.
Yeah.
All this time, whether he's sleeping with students or neglecting his kids, he's going to daily mass, and it means something real to him. And he is completely persuaded of his own vocation. It wasn't fame, it wasn't fortune, but it was who he was going to be.
Yeah.
What was the force of that very Catholic word, vocation, in his life? And I want to hear about it in your own.
Yeah, it was remarkably strong and forever focused with my old man, this notion of art as a vocation. You know, he was poor his whole life. I mean, towards the end, he got a MacArthur Genius Award, but he never got big advances ever. He still has this wonderful Boston publisher, Godin, and you know, it's not a wealthy press. His life was writing, and he'd be the first to tell you. And I think I actually wrote these lines, but he'd be the first to tell you that he put the best part of himself into his writing. It was only when I became a father myself that I realized, boy, you sure did. You know, but you know, I have to say though, man, when writing Townie, I felt no anger. I felt no anger. I felt no self-pity. I felt no nothing like that. I maybe because I'm 51 and I was turning 50 as I was writing it, and I just wanted to capture it as it was. I just wanted to just paint it. I just wanted to. That great line from Flannery O'Connor, the job of the actual is to simply make, the job of the writer is to simply make actual the mystery of our time on earth. And That's all I was trying to do. And I think he spent his whole adult life doing that quite successfully as an artist. You know, he's one of my favorite writers, and you know, his work will live on and on for quite a while.
Who are your other faves?
Well, you know, I read more poets than fiction writers. I read poetry every day. I have one. I have a poem in my pocket I haven't looked at yet. Somebody slipped it to me at a reading last night. I love Stephen Dunn, Marie Howe, Mark Doty, Edward Hirsch, Carolyn Forshay, Sharon Olds. I read poetry every day. I'm reading a beautiful memoir because I've read very few. I haven't read the big famous ones, but I'm reading another Bullshit Night in Suck City by Nick Flynn. I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
I discovered Ron Rash this past year. Have you read his novel Serena, which I believe won the Penn Faulkner Award a couple of years? Love Alice Munro, the short story writer. So many. I mean, I think Yale Doctor is a longtime favorite.
But the writer in Townie is always examining himself about what's this about? What good does it do? What's the effect of all this stuff?
Yeah.
Where do you come out on the social project of the writer?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked, because I've changed quite a bit since I was wrestling with that question of what the hell does art do. That was left over from my Marxist years. I still think, you know, look, right now in Libya, we need to be bringing in some guns over there. And then we need to be fighting this son of a bitch. Poetry later, guns now. But I don't think a life is worth living without art and literature and music and beauty. And it took me a few years to realize that. And honestly, it's because I was a Milltown kid who never read, and I never went to a movie, and I never saw a painting, and I listened to Top 40 radio. What did I know about art?
Like, you didn't even play baseball or football.
I didn't even know what it was. And now I love it, man. I'm just if you can get me tickets to Fenway, let me know.
I wondered, could you explain that to Cody Perkins if he rose from the dead and put his fist down?
Well, you know, here's
this was the kid who tore into a schoolmate who was 100 pounds heavier and ripped him to pieces.
I mean, just knocked him out. Cody became a prize fighter, pretty well-known prize fighter, professional fighter. And, oh, by the way, no, Cody also became a painter. Late in his life, he began to paint canvases, but he died, and I think it was drugs. I've met a lot of Cody's over the years. You know, I work in corrections. I talk a little bit about that in the book. Right. So I began to work with inmates before I began to work in college classrooms and high school classrooms. I feel as if I have a lot of Cody Perkinses and Clay Whalens in my life, and I don't try to punch them anymore. I try to get them to speak their truth and see the value of crying and laughing and expressing yourself. Here's the thing. I don't want to get on a soapbox, but again, writing this book brought me to this realization. I think that American men are taught they can have three emotions to express, and that's it. And they're aggression, aggression, and aggression. That's it. Especially in blue-collar neighborhoods. You're not expected to do anything but express those things. And art saved my life, and I don't want to reduce it too much to that. But if I had not gotten on the road that fiction writing put me on, I would have been on the road that ends either in putting someone in a grave and going to prison or getting put in a grave yourself. I love that line from Hemingway, the job of the writer is not to judge, but to seek to understand. Now, we know he could probably be a judgmental bastard like everybody else, but in his writing, you could feel him trying to just be these people. Mm. And that's a philosophy artistically I've always subscribed to and identify with. I just want to be these people. I don't want you to know who even wrote this book. I'm just trying to be this woman in this truck after her husband's left her. And that sustained act of empathy that daily fiction writing demands made it really hard for me to then that night in a bar room just punch him in the face because he hit his wife. I still want to punch a man in the face who hits his wife, but I haven't in years. I haven't punched anyone 23 years. I talk to them instead. I'm prepared to punch if I have to, but I don't ever want to. I don't ever want to punch anyone ever again. And I have to say, the little boy in me sitting here before you is still proud of the fighter I became, and I still would like to try it out now and then. That little boy would. Mm. But the man, no. Violence creates violence. I want nothing to do with it.
What's so fascinating to me, Andre Dubuis, if I can say it briefly, is how familiar this world is. I live in, you know, university center of the world, Boston and Massachusetts, high tech, pretty well off, medical capital of the universe. But this world of druggies and fuck-ups and illegitimacies and family crises and criminals and prison time is also a world I've come to know very, very well. It's amazing to me how much you got into your book, but also how integral it is to sort of every experience of 21st century Boston.
I completely agree. I mean, one of the frustrating things for me when I'm traveling around the country is people think, oh, you're from Boston. And they, of course, they see that Roman numeral three. Oh, yeah, you guys, it's all like the Kennedys over there.
Trust one city.
The Kennedys. Are you kidding me? Only the Kennedys are like the Kennedys. And by the way, no one talks like the Kennedys but the Kennedys either, by the way. I said, no, man, go see the Departed, Mystic River, the town. I mean, this is much more the kind of the fighter. This is much more the kind of New England I know and the Boston area I know. You know, I have this belief, and I tell my writing students, look, if all you do is combine these things, combine curiosity. William Stafford, the poet, said, the poet must put himself into a state of receptivity before writing. Mm-hmm. And he described receptivity as, one, a willingness to accept anything that comes, no matter what it is, and two, a willingness to fail. If you do that and you combine that with concrete, central, specific detail and active verbs and lean, mean language, which can be taught, it always leads to characters in trouble. It's just where it goes. Because guess what? We're all in trouble at all times, and that's normal. It's not anything to bitch and moan about. In America, we bitch and moan because we're supposed to be happy. That's why we're sick. We're not supposed to be happy. We're supposed to be joyous, which includes grief, by the way. That's my soapbox. I'm off it.
Well, you taught me to lean back on my back foot when the moment comes and go for it.
It's always from the back foot. It's just like hitting a ball, apparently, but I've never done that.
Andrew DeBuse, it's a great pleasure to see you again and to say straight out, the book is the real thing. You're the real thing.
Thank you, sir. I'm
very, very grateful for the life that went into it and very grateful for this conversation today.
Oh, I'm grateful to you, Chris. Thank you very much.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.